Okay, I've been asked to give you a very elementary talk, and so what I want to do is to give you an introduction to quantum field theory in twister space. So just as a kind of list of credits with all of this work, the names of people I've been working with: Tim Adamo, research student quite recently, Rutger Bowles was also associated with this work from some years ago, Matt Villamore, and who's also a research student, and David Skinner, who's who's here and who will interrupt me and explain how badly I'm explaining things to you at various stages. Okay, so the whole theme of this conference is really sort of, or this meeting is somehow on-shell methods and such like. And but what I'm actually going to try to explain to you today is how it is that many of the things that we're seeing as remarkable advances in understanding amplitudes that are being presented as on-shell methods can also be understood in an off-shell context but via normal quantum field theoretic methods, but in twister space. So in order to understand scattering amplitudes and correlation functions, so in particular the Wilson loop, there really isn't some, by the time you're talking about a correlation function at least, it's very hard to proceed without actually going via field theory, although there are recursion methods and such like. And what I want to try to get across to you today is how simple that can be. So there are various reasons why you might want to not work in twister space. So first of all, the in twister space, everything is chiral, so you can't see left, right, so space-time, of course, everything's symmetric, but in twister space, all the representations can be chiral. In twister space, you cannot see locality. In fact, it's really sort of part of the point of twister space is that it has a non-local correspondence with space-time. And so you can't really see space-time locality. It'll come out at the end of the day, but you can't see it. And unitarity is not manifest. I mean, it's not to say you can't prove it, it's just it's a palaver. Whereas on space-time, it is manifest. So these are all reasons why twister space is problematic. But reasons why it's good.
Is there another reason as well?
Oh, sorry, there may be plenty of others, sorry.
Well, I mean, it's set up for and only for conformally.
Well, you could say that about conformally compactified Minkowski space as well. But then you choose infinity and you if you were perverse, you could start on the quadric in CP5 and say that's where physics is, and then say, well, actually, if I want to do gravity, I've got to choose a scale. So in twister space, you can do the same thing. You can choose a scale, and you can choose additional structures. So it's not so bad. It does come back to haunt us, because the only gravity theory we know how to do easily is conformal supergravity. We do. So there is some force to your comment. Okay, so of course one of the advantages that I was about to say, following on from that comment is why it's good to work in twister space, we do have manifest superconformal invariants, and so it's certainly not manifest on space-time, and we can also have maximal off-shell supersymmetry. And I guess it's a standard fact that that's, I don't know if it's a theorem, but it seems to be a standard fact that that's not true on space-time. And these last two facts lead to considerable simplicity in the twister formulation. Whereas calculations on space-time are hard. So a lot of the recent developments have somehow implicitly or explicitly used twisters for various reasons, as Marcus was telling us last week. Maybe I don't need to give you a long list as to what these things were, but there's the original twister string tree formula, there's the MHV formalism. These are all things that are easy in twister space, the Grassmannian residue formula, and just various coordinatizations for the kinematics when you come to study amplitudes and ADS-CFT, that people find it easy to use twister variables. Okay, so so still going on sort of about twister space versus space time, what I want to do is to explain how to calculate amplitudes. So hopefully I'll get to the stage of being able to calculate some simple amplitudes today. But
your last question bugs me a little bit. Your maximal off-cell supersymmetry. How many supercharges are you referring to there? You mean 32 real components?
Well, everything's complex in twister space. The easiest way to say it is we have a super space formalism with manifest n equals 4. I'm talking about super angles. So gravity, self-dual gravity, we can do with manifest.
Just the Carl supersymmetry. Right.
It's full Yang-Mills and chiral Einstein gravity, or full conformal supergravity, can all be done with maximal superspace.
I don't really believe you have 16 supercharges.
Well, these are chiral representations.
It's the same count as you could have done in Minkowski space, but you've organized it differently. I don't think you have the 16 real supercharges.
Everything's so complex that I hesitate to.
Complex field is the real fields in my bag.
There's a group you have.
Because people tend to argue one way or another about notation. I count real components. My question's clear.
Okay. Well, I mean, I could.
Write down what he actually has, and then.
I could just skip ahead to a definition of a twister space, which is this non-projective twister space. T twister space is C4/4. And it's the fundamental representation of the superconformal group, the spinner double cover of SU22/4. So you know how SU22/4 acts on the space.
And all 32 generators are off-shell, realizing.
He's talking about 16 rather than 32. He's doing Yang-Mills,
there's PSU224S, of course, 32, Q and S, and they're all off-shell. You all have some off-shell.
Yes, so that's what I'll be explaining. How it is that that's all realized. Okay, so. Anyway, so the things that we've been able to do in the last year or so, amplitudes and correlation functions of holomorphic Wilson loops. And this is a part of the same story that many people in this room have been exploring on space-time concerning the duality between amplitudes and Wilson loops. the ordinary source on space-time, and so where twister theory has really been powerful here is in extending this correspondence. So this correspondence was already understood for certain examples at one and two loops for the MHV amplitude, and because of the supersymmetry, we were able to actually extend the Wilson loop to get a supersymmetric generalization. And in fact, so from the point of view of Dave and myself, the holomorphic Wilson loop was the easy thing to do. And then lots of people started bugging us about what it actually really meant in space-time. And so we were able to follow through various correspondences and define a supersymmetric Wilson loop in space-time. Simultaneously, Simon also has something which actually turns out not to be quite the same. So here's a that this has some insertions, although it does turn out that the two are essentially the same.
These are all light-like?
These are all polygonal light-like Wilson loops. And you need to go to the 2D generalization to describe the whole amplitude. This was just giving us the MHV sector. And this now gives you the whole amplitude. And one of the things that's becomes clear from understanding this, so after this work, we spent several months trying to really understand this space-time version quite a lot better. A lot of people were telling us that this was really the way to go for various reasons. But when you actually start doing it, you find it's actually quite horrific to go through the details here on space-time. In the paper that Dave and I wrote, we wrote down the NMHV tree amplitude, the N squared MHV tree amplitude. We could see, in fact, that the Feynman diagram decomposition comparison between these two was just simple planar duality. And we could write down examples just in a few pages, which involve one loop MHV, one loop NMHV, two loop MHV. At the level of the loop integrand, and you know, we just write down a whole lot of stuff, and the only thing stopping us was time. Here, it's a real struggle to even get the NMHV right, and in fact, it's quite a tour de force of calculation to do so. In fact, it's really Simon. I don't think we've ever done it with our version of the space-time Wilson loop. And you've got to chase logarithmic singularities around the diagram. You've got to do it for one component, and then try and extend it by supersymmetry, and so on and so on. So the twist. What I'm trying to emphasise here is that the twister theory is really embodying some very, very dramatic simplification. Okay. Anyway, so that's the hard sell. Sorry.
So it embodies and allows you to do simple calculations. And is there a simple way of then going back to space time? That hard?
Well, I mean, I guess you see, for the classical physics, I guess there are standard algorithms. These things all get corrupted by quantum field theory, you know. So classically, it was easy for us to sort of write down. One of the things that was striking here is, in order to write this down, at the time we actually made a sort of an error in the paper. We had to actually impose some on-shell conditions before the space-time Wilson loop was even defined. So this thing is actually defined completely off-shell. Whereas on space-time, you have to impose three of the field equations.
What does it mean for a Wilson loop to be off-shell?
You have a correlation function that's a function of your variables, defined whether the field equations are satisfied or not. Whereas here, we were only able to construct a supersymmetric Wilson loop on space-time if we assumed that some of the field equations were satisfied. It was simply not defined. If not. And this would be reflected also in Simon's approach just by the statement that there'd be an ambiguity in what he meant by his Wilson loop up to adding on terms in some of the field equations. And there's always a risk that such things generate anomalies if you can only define it on shell.
To be deliberately provocative, why do you want to go back to space-time? Specifically, if you want to compare the Wilson loop to the scattering amplitude.
I'd like to know what I'm talking about.
The scattering amplitude is going to be written in twister space anyway.
Right.
But the scattering amplitude is going to be written in twister space anyway. At least many people write it that.
Well, I think it's a fair point that people want to know that you want to do a reality check, and that's perfectly predictable. Okay, so this is the reason why I think it's actually, you know, most people take the attitude that, well, maybe some people come along and do something nice in twister space, but I'm going to see what that means in space time.
A lot of these things you're discussing have divergences.
Oh yeah. Well, I'm also waving a rather unsatisfactory magic wand of the so-called loop integrand. So that is to say that what we've been calculating here is actually the not the integral of the amplitude, but the integrand, and by that means we're shelving precisely this issue. Of the divergences. In our context, what we're doing is I won't get onto this, but when you look at the holomorphic Wilson loop, you find that you're just adding an extra leg into your adding an extra operator at some random field point to discuss the integrand. Well, I mean, people can play these games on space-time, so that would be how Simon would phrase it. He would just insert an operator at some point in space-time. That point would need to be integrated over to construct the integral of the loop integrand, but you can just leave it as a constant in the parameter, a constant parameter. This is of course a serious issue that we do need to know how to regulate, and this would be one of the criticisms leveled at twister theory. I'm trying not to level any criticisms at twister theory at this point. But anyway,
so far, twister theory doesn't have a natural regularization scheme.
Essentially, that's right. I mean, there are regularization schemes that one could imagine imposing in twister space. The so-called massive regularization, which is just a deformation of n=4 GPA mils to put a VEV on some of the scalars, is something that's easily implementable on twister space, but we haven't actually done so.
Isn't another shortcoming, in a sense, the fact that twister space is very special to four dimensions?
Well, yes, okay, so...
And dimensional regularization, no analog.
Absolutely. So dimensional regularization is not our preferred way to proceed. That's right, for that kind of reason. I mean, on the other hand, one can say that with these Wilson loop approaches, the twister variables are. So this is what Andrew will talk about this afternoon. So if you want to think of the holomorphic Wilson loop as actually providing an amplitude, then here I'm just saying there's one twister space, but in the way that it relates to the amplitude, it relates via momentum twisters, and they are essentially a coordinate reformulation of momentum space. So you are, in this approach, getting the loop integrand on momentum space, and standard momentum space methods could then be used. But I don't really like that get out. I mean, I'd rather like to be able to do it all at the level of the amplitude.
Is there a context for the discussion of conformal anomalies?
We see conformal anomalies already at tree level. Sorry. Which conformal anomaly? Sorry.
Well, loop anomaly, standard trace anomaly. N=4 is safe from that, but you might want to discuss
it with you. Yeah. Well, the twister action can be reduced to other degrees of supersymmetry, and that there's still a lot of work to be done there.
What do you mean that the conformal anomaly can be seen at tree level?
Sorry, what I meant by that was something which is probably different from what Kelly meant, which is this. Maybe I should say it when I set up machinery, because the it's a question of gauge invariance. And whether
linear singularity.
Yeah, I mean, the collinear singularities just at tree level are already obstructing the gauge invariance on twister space.
Can you see something like the conformal anomaly at one loop, for example? Something. Because that's important to extend partial evolution loop.
That's right. So, again, you see, this is a defect of working with the integrand, is that that's something which we... I'm embarrassed to say we haven't really investigated it. I mean, this is... Okay, so NEMA has given us a magic wand to sort of, or magic, not wand, but it's a brush to sweep various issues under the carpet until we can handle them a bit better of telling us that the loop integrand is okay. But what you're all telling me here is that we've got to go further than the loop integrand to really get to grips with some of these anomalies. And as I say, I mean, some of these issues are already there at tree level, which, okay. So this is hopefully makes twister space something that you can sort of get your hands on as a definition of twister space, fundamental representation space of the superconformal group, and as such it has four bosonic components and four fermionic. So we might often write this in that style here. So these are the fermions, and it's traditional to break up the bosonic part into a pair of spinners, and these two have a slightly different status, and the way to see that is actually to understand how this relates to space-time. So, the correspondence with space-time is via the instance relation. And this is given by mu a prime. So I should apologize for the fact I use a non-standard spinner index notation. And so what this gives you is this is just a set of algebraic equations, and you can understand it in two different ways. So if you fix a point in space-time, so that's x and theta, so this is this would be space-time chiral super Minkowski space. And if you fix a point in space-time, x, then as lambda varies, this gives you a line in twister space, Lx. And you think of lambda A as being coordinates on the Riemann sphere, homogeneous coordinates on the Riemann sphere. So that is to say, lambda A is equivalent to some non-zero multiple of lambda A. It's only when the ratio of the two components is playing a role in that the description of this line. So I forgot to say that what we actually deal with is projective space, and so that's a space of where you quotient out by scalings. Okay, so. So a point in space-time corresponds to a line in twister space, and you think of that line, that Riemann sphere, as actually parametrizing the light cone through the point. And if you were to have another point y on that light cone, then the two lines in twister space would actually intersect. So this is, bosonically, this is a three space. So your intuition about lines in space just works. And it's a codimension one condition for two lines to meet. And that means that x and y are null separated. And you can think of this point z, at least in real Minkowski space, as defining a light ray, although in the complex, this is two equations, and so it defines a complex two-plane, which is a totally null alpha plane. So in complex Z corresponds to a two plane, which is totally null and subdual. Okay, so that's the basic geometry of twister space, and And now you can start to think about how we're going to do field theory on twister space. So our space PT is going to have some field defined on it. And for the purposes of Yang-Mills theory, the basic field is going to be a norm one form. With values in the Lie algebra of your favorite great gauge group. And we can, so by a 0-1 form, I just mean that it's certainly got anti-holomorphic coordinates and as a one-form dz bars, and this geometrically defines a d-bar operator on some holomorphic vector bundle. Well, on a vector bundle, sorry. So it's easy to write down the action for self-dual theory. So the so self-dual Yang-Mills on space-time will correspond to the action S. So this would be familiar to many people as a holomorphic Tern-Simons action. And in this, the I've written down a holomorphic volume form, which so if you look at this, you've got four z's there. So this, we're always in the business of calculating homogeneity when we're working on the projected twister space. So we're allowed to rescale your twisters. Z goes to alpha times z. So the bosonic part goes with alpha to the fourth. But the fermionic part, because of the laws of fermionic integration, chi goes to alpha chi, but d chi goes to 1 over alpha d chi. And so this is super Clava-Yau. And so this holomorphic Tern-Simons action is well defined on twister space. And so then the question is, what does this mean in so we could ask what this actually means in linear theory. So if you just do the U1 case, then we have the field equation d bar A equals 0, and gauge freedom A goes to A plus d bar F. And so the gauge equivalence classes are defined by what's called cohomology, which are just the of solutions. H1, usually you just work on some open set in Twister space. The whole of Twister space doesn't have any cohomology. This is like working in some region in Minkowski space rather than the full complex compactification. So this is equal to A d bar A equals 0 over A equals d bar F. So the...
That doesn't depend on U?
Well, sorry, so U, for example, could be complex Minkowski space. So, for example, it could be a real slice. So that could be a real Lorentzian signature Minkowski space. It could be the future tube, if you wanted to discuss positive frequency fields. So those are the points in complex Minkowski space whose imaginary parts are future time-like, or the past tube that's past time-like. And the imaginary parts past time-like, and those are used for discussing positive and negative frequency fields in Twister space. And but if you just wanted to discuss if U equals a real Minkowski space, then U equals Z dot Z bar equals 0. So this is an SU22 slash 4 in Minkowski signature. And so you have this indefinite Hermitian form on the bosonic Twister space. And this would then be the region you would get. So in quantum field theory, though, you might be interested in the positive frequency fields or negative frequency fields. And so that might give you different choices for you.
So one question. Is Twister space not compact, right? So.
Well, Twister space is compact, but the compact Minkowski space, compact Twister space corresponds to complexified, compactified Minkowski space. And if you actually have a field that's defined on the whole of complexified, compactified Minkowski space, then by Liouville theorem it'll be constant or zero. So in fact, you always need to work on some subregion on Twister space if you want to have fields living there in the same way that you always work on a real slice of space-time.
So is there a preferred infinity?
Not in this description here, no. This is still a conformally invariant notion. But it's... Yeah. Okay, so just to say a little bit more about how you get back to a description you're familiar with, if you expand out in the super variables, then we get a bunch of components. We always require that it's holomorphic in the fermionic coordinates. I'll just abbreviate. And as you can see, you'll get A had weight 0. It's just an ordinary 0, 1 form. But because chi has weight 1, this will have weight minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, and minus 4. And these different parts will correspond to the different helicity components of the super Yang-Mills multiplet. And so the... Oops. And... there's an easy way to get the corresponding field back on space-time, which I'll just give you the one for the scalar field. So if you want to know what phi ij is at x, then you just write an integral over the line ax of this little phi ij times lambda d lambda. And there exists an analogous formula for all of the various fields, but this gives you the space-time solution to the zero rest mass field equation. So here I'm integrating over the CP1, this line LX, and in doing so I'm having to put the coordinates through that line and well, you've got theta chi, theta lambda, lambda d lambda. And if you just integrate under the integral sign, differentiate under the integral sign, you'll see that this thing satisfies the wave equation. So it's quite elementary to see that you get solutions to the that these cohomology classes give solutions to the Fields equations. So okay. So then there's a statement that that was just the U1 case. But there's a statement which I won't prove, which is that if you go up to the general gauge group case, well, the field equations here are that this d bar operator in general, d bar plus a squared, so the field equations should be equal to zero, and that means that this is a holomorphic vector bundle. And Ward back in the 70s proved that such a thing would correspond to a self-dual field. And all this other stuff here just gives the supersymmetric completion if you do this with some supersymmetry involved. Okay, so. Well, that's there's more of a procedure than an inversion. So in split signature, there's a nice inversion, and this has been very useful. So in split signature, there's a well, in fact, it's easiest to do it via momentum space, where you have a half Fourier transform from momentum space back to twisted space. But it's not so mechanical in other signatures. That's why people are focused on split signature in twisted applications, is because of that simplicity.
So why is this off shell?
Well, this action here is off shell, but this transform here is on shell. I mean, had I done this without imposing field equations, I wouldn't have got something sensible on space-time. The thing that is going to be off shell is the calculation of amplitudes and correlation functions on twisted space.
So when you convert to space-time, you can't get anything off shell in space-time.
Well, I mean, the correspondence starts to fail, because this integral here, if phi was not d bar closed, then this would not be gauge invariant, this integral. Sorry, I said that completely wrong. It would be gauge invariant. But if you did it off shell, it certainly wouldn't, well, you wouldn't expect it to satisfy any field equations. But you wouldn't be able to go back and get all the information here. These are free functions of 6 variables. Space-time is a free function of 4 variables.
So the off-shell is really in twister space, not in space-time.
I mean, like, oh, yeah, yeah.
Right. Okay.
And this was a statement already about the Wilson loop. We could define the Wilson loop completely off-shell in twister space, but in order to translate it onto space-time, we had to impose some field equations to make it make sense.
Okay. Could you imagine there's a path integral?
Yeah. I mean, the path integral based on this action, but I'm going to introduce a supplementary term as well, because this, of course, is just a self-dual theory, and I need to add the interactions required to complete it to the full Yang-Mills theory. But I was going to digress on some formalism first before I add the extra ingredient, because the
just on the off-shell, you might want to say that you can define the transformation off-shell in Euclidean signature.
That's true. Yes, you can.
But that's, of course, no use for light-like Wilson loops.
But you still have the problem that an arbitrary off-shell object in twisted space is a function of 6 variables, whereas on space-time it's 4. So there's a good deal more off-shell freedom on twisted space, which may or may not be a good thing. But anyway.
But having integrated it like this, it's a function of 4.
That's right, but you've integrated out 2 variables, so.
You get something.
Even that's
if
right.
The field equations aren't satisfied.
That's right.
Which is a function of 4 variables.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What? But that's not an off-shell.
Well, it is off-shell. Okay. So, but it doesn't contain all the information that you had in twister space. Well, I'm just the data of this phi. So I guess the point is that if you were to write down this d bar plus a all squared, that would give you a quantity which was a full function of 6 variables, and it would not vanish off shell. And you know, it would have invariants that you could write down which were pre-functions of 6 variables. So you couldn't encode it into this space-time field. So the gauge freedom doesn't knock out the 6 variables off-shell in the way that it does off on-shell. Okay. Now, we sort of had this picture, and indeed the interaction terms to. So this needs an extra interaction term to make this the full Yang-Mills theory, which, I'll tell you about in a moment. But we had all of this several years ago. But what's really been an advantage recently is that several years ago we were using momentum eigenstates, and of course that's breaking conformal invariants, and it's so you can represent momentum eigenstates on twister space quite easily, and translate anything you calculate with this back to momentum space. But you destroy the invariances, and you quickly get a formalism which is as hard to calculate with as anything else. Or at least it's just cumbersome. I mean, it's the simplicity is obscured. And so what has been a big help recently is to introduce the idea of a state which is supported at a twister. And these are essentially just going to be delta functions at a twister. And so this, when you're working on twister space, takes the place of the momentum eigenstate that you'd use if you're working on momentum space. So
ordered at a point in twister space.
Yes, that's right. So a momentum eigenstate is supported at a point in momentum space. And so here we want to have something that's supported at a point in twister space. The word elemental states is one that Sir Andrew coined, I guess, many years ago for something which it wasn't defined in this way, but it has similar kind of properties. We need some delta functions. So a complex delta function is easiest defined just by thinking about the kernel of the d-bar operator on the plane, so just on C. The coordinate z, well, we have, if you throw in 2 pi I guess, this is, where's the 2 pi I go? Anyway, so this is a delta function in the real part times the imaginary part, so if z is equal to x plus I, y, times dz bar. So this will support you at the origin of the complex plane. And this, this representation shows you, so I'll define this just to be delta bar 1 of z, and the 1 is counting the form degree, not the number of delta functions, which are which is obviously a pair of them. And of course, for the fermionic coordinates, we have delta 0, 1 of some fermionic chi. It's just chi. It's follows from the standard Berezinian rule for integration, which will chi d chi equals 1. Fermionic case. And so with this, we can almost write down a delta function on twister space. Well, we can do it on a non-projective twister space just by multiplying these things up for all the components. And then again for the fermionic components. And but this is a non-projective object, and we can get a projective object by integrating out by a scaling. And so this will be times the S over S. So again, the Calabi-Yau nature of super twister space means that this thing has weight 0 in its various arguments, and integrating out the S over S means the whole thing has weight 0 in its arguments. So this, in some sense, will define us what we will call an elemental state, which would be a wave function supported at the twister Z prime. And really, what we're going to do is we're going to think of this. This is actually a three form, but it's a three form in both variables. And so you could think of this as being in omega naught 1 of the kind of the z space, and omega naught 2 of the z prime space, and as a naught 3 form. And so you could think of the H1 part as being, for the elemental state, you have this as a 0-1 form in Z and 0-2 form part in Z prime. So it takes values in 0-2 forms maybe if I think of this as an external particle or external point, Zi, then this would be a 0-2 form in the Zi.
Sorry, it's not symmetric under Z prime?
This definition is symmetric, but if you want to think of it as an elemental state, you're always going to insert it as if it were a 0-1 form into the various formulae as a wave function. And so this is going to be your candidate for curly A as depending on Z. And then the point is that this will then allow you to integrate against a general wave function in the Zi variable to get your amplitude as a function of arbitrary wave functions. But we'll just present it in terms of the Zi. So this 0-2 form part is important for allowing you to do that integration.
Wait, but to say it again, it's a 0-3 form on the product space. And so it has pieces that are all form degrees adding up to 3 in both bits. But when you use it as an amplitude, you just...
Maybe I shouldn't have explained that. It's just easy just to see a delta function and, Okay. There's a question mark as to what these things actually are. And they are slightly curious. So if you just do that evaluation on space-time, then we're going to get integral over Lx of this delta function, delta bar 3, Z, Zi, lambda, d lambda. If you work it out, you end up with delta bar 2 of mu I minus x times lambda i. And so this is actually going to be a solution to the wave equation that's supported on an alpha plane in the complex Minkowski space.
What's it
meant? So this is meant to be the mu I minus and this is it's a rather subtle object, but anyway, we can. I'll in order to get to a point where I can do some stuff, So in its intersection with the real slice, it's just supported on a light ray, but it's best to think of this in the complex Minkowski space, where it's supported on a whole alpha plane, taking our complex 2 plane. Now, just to develop this further, you see, we're going to want to... So this is what's going to be the wave function. We're also going to want to have propagators, which are going to be the Green's function for the D-bar operator, and this calculus of delta functions extends. So just so that I can have these things available, we can sort of carry on this process of integrating out extra parameters to. So we can take our delta bar 3, Z1, and then Z2 plus S, Z3, and integrate that down to get something which is a 0-2 form, /4, which that this implies, or supported when Z1, Z2, Z3 are collinear. And then there's going to be a delta bar 1, /4, when, so I'll just do 1, 2, 3, 4 now. Defined in the same way, ds over s times the delta bar 2, /4, 1, 2, and then 3 plus s, 4. So I hope that's reasonably intuitive. And this that gives you that 1, 2, 3, 4 are coplanar. And then finally, we can get down to something which has no delta functions, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Delta bar 1, /4, 1, 2, 3, 4 plus S, 5. This is also the basic rational dual conformal invariant. Sorry, not dual. This is a rational function now. It's a basic superconformal invariant. And if you remember that we're...
you said the square bracket is the same as delta 0.
That's right, yeah. Superconformal invariant. And this is an object that crops up all throughout anything to do with studying invariants for the superconformal group or the dual conformal group. This is the most basic invariant that we see.
Sorry, can I ask more about the wave function? So it looks like the scalar is you're just getting the incident relations. It's like defining a point in space time.
So that's this is now regarding mu I and lambda I as a constant, although this is also a form in the mu I and the lambda I variables. So it's a 0-2 form in the mu I and lambda I variables. And it's a delta function in the complex Minkowski space supported on a two-plane.
Right, so good. I mean, that makes sense for a scalar. So for the vectors, you get the polarization vectors coming out.
Yeah, it gets more complicated for the other helicities, and I don't care to write them down in public. But I can, but yes, you get the polarization vectors coming out, which will be related to lambda or derivatives. Okay, so that's the calculus, and to a certain extent, you can get away with just using that calculus for an awful lot of calculations. So the rest of what I'll do, there are a couple of things that I'll need here. One of them is just the statement that d bar of delta bar 2/4 1/2/3 is delta bar 3/4 of 1/2 plus delta bar 3/4 2/3 and 3/1. And I guess that's actually all I'll need in the rest. Okay, so now the principal thing that makes this action easy, which I just rubbed out, is to fix an axial gauge. So everyone, I guess, knows that if you have a Chern-Simons theory, that if you impose an axial gauge, then the AQ term vanishes. So you're making it vanish in one direction, and so there's only two independent degrees of freedom, and they're wedged together, and so you get zero. So we do this by choose a reference twister, Z star, and basically we're going to just make the gauge field vanish in all the directions through the point Z star. And so this is the standard thing you might do. I mean, in light cone gauge, you just choose a null direction and you make your connection vanish in that direction. Here it's done by choosing all the directions through a given point Z star. And and so the self-dual Yang-Mills action essentially becomes abelian. And this is a statement that the self-dual theory is integrable, which is sort of well known, so to speak, as a product of the wall construction for twister theory. Okay. So if you want to calculate things in the self-dual sector, then the then there'll be no interaction terms. And we can write down the propagator in this gauge. So this is so has to satisfy the standard equation, and it turns out that in this gauge you have the simple formula, which is that it is just one of these delta functions. Super-conforming invariant delta functions depends on this star. So that was why I went through the palaver of setting up this calculus here. And so the next step is to talk about how to build the full theory. And so we've got the self-dual part plus the remaining interactions of the full theory. And these are given by a formula which is really motivated from Witten's original twister string theory. So it's a slightly formidable formula when you first look at it. So it's non-local in twister space. What you're doing is you're taking this D bar operator that's defined by the bundle, you're restricting it to line X, and you're taking the log of its determinant. And then we integrate this over real space-time. So this is a real slice of space-time. And and this is, of course, Karl super Minkowski space-time. So the log det is what you might get from, certainly a det is what you might get from integrating out some fermions coupled to the bundle along the curve. And the log det means that in some sense you wanted a zeroth power of the D1 instanton. So it turns out that this is getting a bit, probably only of interest to people who studied the original twister string theory. The original twister string theory would have had det there, but it was corrupted by conformal supergravity. The log then means that the it's what gets rid of the conformal supergravity in twister string theory. Okay, so this is
this is supposed to be the full Gamow's action.
So it's non-local in twister space, and that could be seen as a problem. But as we'll see, it's no less computable for that. Now, I'd like to write everything out in a kind of super conformally invariant way. And so this D4/8x is not manifestly super conformally invariant. So what I'll do is I'll rewrite Lx as the line joining Za and Zb. So Z sigma, given that Z is equal to Za plus sigma Zb. And if I do that, then I've made a choice of two points on the line. And I can write this as D4/4 Za D4/4 Zb. But over the volume of GL2, that corresponds to the choice of these two points here. So this is really a D4/8 of the ordinary Karl and Minkowski space because of this quotient here, but I'm now expressing it in a way that is conformally invariant. Now, what you might be more alarmed by is, what on earth do I do with the log det? Because that's something which has a slightly more scary look to it. In this parameterization of the Riemann sphere, so sigma is going to be thought of as an ordinary affine coordinate on the extended complex plane, we can write log det d bar plus a. We can expand this out perturbatively. And so we get sum over n integral L a b now to the n trace product. So we're going to get a z sigma i AI over sigma I minus sigma I plus 1. And this is understood cyclically. Yes. Somebody will probably tell me I need a 1 over n there if that was log debt. Okay. And in fact, we're now getting something which is somewhat reminiscent of the phenomena from Yang-Mills amplitudes, which is that the part Taylor denominator seems to be coming out quite naturally here from this expansion of the log debt. So this is going to be if you put in momentum eigenstate for your fields AI there, then this will be the part Taylor formula directly. But I'm not going to do that. I'll put in the elemental states. Right. Will be just delta bar 3/4 ZZI. And so we'll get the vertices. V1 to n of integral over m. I'll just write it as 8/8 of ZA, ZB, pi I equals 1 to n of 3/4 Z sigma I ZI over sigma I plus 1. Okay, so this is the full interactions of the that take you up to the full Yang-Mills theory, and this leads to this sequence of MHV vertices, one for each n.
One of the sigmas came from inverting del bar.
Yes, absolutely. Sorry, so I missed out that step. So this is this formula here is in some sense d bar inverse AI multiplied together to the end, and
have we stripped out color?
This line, the color was in there. This line, it stripped out.
Okay.
Sorry. Yes, I should have perhaps said that. Color stripped. Okay. Now I need one before. So what I wanted to do is, before I finish today, was to actually calculate an amplitude. But before I do that.
This was derived in the reverse order?
Well, I mean, I guess.
Why should we believe it?
So how was it derived? Well, I guess, to a certain sense, it was motivated from this formula from twister string theory. This was really written down actually for arbitrary curves of arbitrary degree in twister space by Marcus and Nasty and so on, and shown to give the tree amplitude, but in particular it gives the MHV amplitudes. So what you can do is you can express this action with this interaction term on Euclidean space in a gauge which is pulled back directly from space-time. And then when you work out this log debt, you discover that it truncates after a finite order. You discover that the thing which keeps this series going on forever is this, there's parts up, that there are non-trivial parts in the fiber which have zero Grassmann degrees. Because you're only going to allow up to 8 Grassmann degrees here. And if there's nothing that has zero Grassmann degree, then this truncates. And that's what happens if you pull back, if you express this in terms of ingredients from space-time. And so you can just compute all the terms here, evaluate them explicitly, and you get your favourite n equals 4 super Yang-Mills action in a form which is divided up into this self-dual part, a kind of supersymmetric extension of one that was found by Chalmers and Siegel for the standard theory, and an interaction term here, and which corresponds to log det. And but the calculation is really quite explicit.
So there's no such form for purely platonic twister space.
Yeah, there is. Yes. So this self-dual part turns into just a regular BF theory, and then this log det term. Well, you could still write down log det of this, but you just knock out everything except for the top and the bottom term in the multiplet. So you just have the A and the B, and so all you get is two B's. Sorry, I mean, I probably rubbed out my decomposition of the A into something with A at the top and B at the bottom, but this A term will just give you two B's. So you get a version of the action on space-time, which is, in terms of forms, it's B wedge F plus B squared. And this B wedge F, so F is the curvature D sub A squared. B is self-dual. And so without the B squared there, so you can put a coupling constant in, or G squared or something. Without that term in there, B is self-dual, and it's a Lagrange multiplier action for the anti-self-dual Yang-Mills equations. You put this in, and it tells you the self-dual part of F is B, or B is the self-dual part of F. And also then, from this term, you get D self-dual part is zero. So this is the completely, yeah, you know, there's just the vanilla Yang-Mills way of understanding all of that. So this is just a supersymmetric completion. Okay, so so one of the things is, if you stare at this, you'll see that it has very, very confined support. This is just stacked full of delta functions. And okay, you're integrating out one parameter at a time, but you've still got sort of somehow codimension two support. And what this is telling you is that all the particles are lined up along a line. And when you actually start doing amplitude calculations on twister space, that's very restrictive. It means that you can do your integrals against delta functions algebraically. So in order to do this, if you imagine that you've got two MHV vertices with a bunch of legs, and you want to and you want to actually find out what that diagram is as a contribution to what will in fact be the NMHV amplitude, you can say, aha, well, this is going to be kind of VA B plus 1 Z times delta bar 2 slash 4 Z star Z prime, and V A plus 1 up to B Z prime. And we're going to want to just integrate out these twisters now. And this obeys a nice relation. So if you have V 1 up to I, say, and then we have a Z and then an I plus 1 up to N, then we can factor off a delta function times V 1 up to N, where this is now Z independent. And this is just an elementary calculation. You using these sigmas here, we can put S equals something like sigma I minus sigma over sigma sigma minus sigma I plus 1. If the sigma is a parameter associated with Z there, then this will give you, you can integrate out that extra term just to give you this relation. So it turns out that this this is that's one of the NMHV diagrams And this now gives you just V A dot dot B plus one delta bar 2/4 of A Z B plus one delta bar 2/4 Z star Z prime slash four A plus one B Z prime. And that's got to be integrated against 3/4z and 3/4z prime. And well, what can it be? I mean, you integrate. This is some dual conformal invariant that depends on five variables. And integrating against the delta functions, it's very quick to evaluate this as a b plus one star a plus one p. Sorry, I missed out a term. There's another vertex here. So we end up with I peeled off a delta bar 2/4 for this vertex and one for this vertex, and that's these two here. And then we got these vertices a plus one b and a b plus one there. So this is the answer for the n MHV vertex, essentially by integrating algebraically against delta functions. So summing over these gives you the full NMHV amplitude. And okay, so that's just one calculation. But the point here is that this pattern continues. These amplitudes have such restricted support that for generic diagrams, when there are lots of legs and not too many propagators, we can do these integrations, and we end up with an integrated set of Feynman rules for generic diagrams. In the same way that in momentum space we use the delta functions to perform a lot of the integrations, so at tree level there are no residual integrations. But here, what we find is that even at loop level for generic diagrams, there aren't actually residual. So we have an R invariant with a star in the middle for each propagator. And the dots here are the nearest external particles. And if and these are possibly shifted if propagators, so I'll just say perhaps shifted if propagations are adjacent. And we also get a V for each vertex depending only on the external particles of that vertex. So, okay. Now this can be this can be transformed term by term to momentum space, where it gives the MHV rules.
Going much too fast.
Sorry.
You wrote down an expression for an action, not a generating functional amplitude.
Sorry, I'm just writing down what you get for amplitudes if you just follow the Feynman rules for this action. Using these elemental states as scattering states. So.
Well, it looked to me like V came directly from the action.
Yes, so it's a I mean, I read it off from the action rather naively, yeah.
The action generates vertices, and then there are Feynman diagrams with vertices propagating.
Sorry, yeah, so I just did, this is the simplest diagram, which I just did here with two vertices and a propagator. And now here, what I'm trying to do is to say that if you have a general diagram, sort of a general generic diagram, then we'll have one of these R invariants for each propagator, and then one of these vertices with just evaluation on the external particle for each vertex after integrating out. And there's a problem that you get if this depends if the external, if there's less than two particles on an external vertex. You have some integrals left over, and you can't go through this procedure of integrating everything out. But when it comes to correlation functions, you have a similar sort of algebraic way of being able to compute the contributions to a correlation function using these delta functions. But anyway, so the claim here then is you get a set of Feynman rules on twister space in terms of these variables, which gives you a form of the amplitude which is very unfamiliar. But you could then evaluate it on momentum eigenstates, take it back to momentum space, and if you do that, term by term, you'll be getting the so-called MHV rules on momentum space.
And you're talking about loop level there as well, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, the point is that this integration procedure does not break down at loop level in the same way it does on momentum space because of the this very restricted support you have for the vertices. But I'm sort of less confident of the calculations there because I'm not quite sure that I've incorporated the Feynman I epsilon prescription properly. And
the level of the integram, I mean, before you actually.
Yeah, but here I'm doing the integrals, you see, so I'm not quite sure.
Start out in space, not in the minimum space. What do you mean by the integrand?
Well, here, yeah, okay, so the integrand is not an issue until you start going to the momentum twister space, until you start studying the correlation function of the Wilson loop, and you go to the momentum twister space description. So this is really in fundamental twister space. Momentum twister space is something you can only construct for planar theories.
If you were to transform back to momentum space,
yeah.
I assume the loop momentum integrals are still there. They have not been performed in anything you're talking about, if you were to carry out the transform.
Well, if you do it ingredient by ingredient, that's the case. But if you just transform the external particles back, then you expect the loop integrals to have been performed. They may not have been performed correctly, but they expect them to have been performed.
But what does that mean? When you've done a loop integral, you get polylogs, for example.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Where are the polylogs?
That's right. So I guess the trouble is we haven't done a simple loop example here, but the polylogs would come under Fourier transform.
Well, maybe this is something that could be looked at. I mean,
One
loop, the thing could be torn apart and completely studied to death.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, the paper that we put on the archive on this was meant to be a tree-level paper, and so here,
so there are,
stuff needs to be done.
If you do loops in position space, mm-hmm. you can work in whatever, you encounter the same kind of divergence issues.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you expect to get divergence issues wherever you are, and you can see divergences arising in this picture here, because if you have, say, two propagators between the same two vertices here, what you discover, just a naive picture here, I mean, this isn't quite right, but both those vertices correspond to lines in twister space, and then you discover that the propagators correspond to lines that are transversal to these two lines, but these two are inserted here, so ideally they'd be inserted at separate points. But what you discover is that there's only one transversal to these two lines that goes through this reference twister. And so these two points are squashed together. Mm-hmm. And these MHV vertices have poles at those two points. So this picture here formally leads directly to a kind of a 1 over 0 squared. Now, you get some powers of 0 in the numerator from something like this as well. And in fact, as it stands, we haven't managed to figure out what's cancelling and how it cancels. It doesn't cancel in a naive way. I mean, the powers are actually simply wrong for it to cancel in a naive way. So we haven't figured out how to even do that simplest of loop diagrams. Whereas the non-planar version isn't too bad. The non-planar version is fine. So in fact, the simplest one to analyze, just to see where polylogs are, is to do this non-planar. Is to the non-planar LHB.
Well, when you say that's one of the theories you're talking about, the supersymmetric theory, the complete supersymmetric theory, you...
Well, so I guess if you don't have the supersymmetry in there, then the zeros in the numerator are going to go away, and it's going to start to diverge. In supersymmetric theory, you've got some zeros in the numerator, and we actually simply don't know how to do the calculation at this point.
So you don't have the analog contourism.
We've got some half-baked ways of understanding how epsilon comes in, but it involves going back to momentum space and back again and fiddling in a... I'm not satisfied with the way that we understand those things at the moment.
If you're doing Euclidean,
Well, you see, the correlation functions are much more civilized. But then, of course, you get to the issue that the first correlation functions that we start looking at are ones where there's some null separation. So, so those are the ones that aren't so civilized.
You might, the way of getting the right contour description.
Oh yeah,
we
yeah.
Analytically continue from.
That's right. That's right. You see, the contour occurs here in the definition of the vertex, and. So I'm still sort of slightly unclear as to how set in stone that contour is. So I've been sort of just taking this to be real Minkowski space, and you need to do that if you want this to have crossing symmetry. If you tilt it off into the Euclidean, then it's difficult to see how you can get crossing symmetry manifest in this formalism. Whereas it is manifest if this is Lorentzian real. So maybe there's some I epsilon that one can do and still keep it sort of real, but you can sort of think. Anyway, I'm certainly not satisfied with the way I understand it at the moment. But. Okay, anyway, so that was. I'm sorry, actually, I've taken up a ridiculous amount of time. So.
But the claim in the end is that the quantum rules you use from here will reproduce.
Yeah, I mean, we need to. I mean, you've uncovered some gaps in my knowledge already with your questions. there are many things that we need to learn how to do here, which are standard on momentum space.
And roughly speaking, until you do go back to momentum space for the external particles, you just have sort of function.
That's what seems to be coming out from this, and there's a similar pattern comes up when you look at correlation functions. And I'm not sure. We haven't done any of the kind of very serious correlation function computations beyond what's required for the loop integrand and the Wilson loop correspondence. But,
Let's thank Lionel.